This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today with
Sophie. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
You recall in the not too distant past, the media swooped down on the southern border and were showing scenes of hundreds, if not thousands, of people migrating across the Rio Grande into the United States. There were drones flying over, video of what was actually happening, stops that were actually being made. And the Biden administration, much like in the aftermath of Katrina that we experienced here, the federal government's response was, we got to remove this blister from the media. We've got to do something that's going to be different. And the Biden administration did. They set up the CBP One app where you could do everything electronically. So you could actually migrate to this country, not necessarily in a legal way, by virtue of filling out an app and get in here. And now the Trump administration seems as though they want to address this. Ira Melman from FAIR joins us. Ira, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
Ira, any disagreement with the characterization of what happened in the beginning of CBP One?
Yeah, I mean, the purpose of that CBP One app was to obscure the extent of illegal immigration into the United States. The Biden administration, which at the time was, you know, the president was running for re-election, he understood that those scenes of people pouring across the border in record numbers was not going to bode well for his re-election campaign. But he didn't want to stop it. He just wanted to make it less visible to the American public. And so they created this phone app that said, you know, if you use the app and get an appointment at a border crossing station, we will let you in through the legal port of entry. You're still in the country illegally. You have no business being here. You have no legal eligibility to enter the United States. But they decided they were going to use the power of parole to allow literally millions of people to come across the border, even though they were ineligible to enter the United States. So this was really just an attempt to pull the wool over the American public's eyes. The Trump administration, when they came in on the very first day, canceled the use of the CBP One app. And now they're taking the next step and trying to get those people who came into the United States with the app. As I said, these people are still illegal aliens. They are deportable. And the new administration has decided that these people need to go home.
So the Biden administration waves this magic wand about parole, but I thought parole was to be used sparingly and on an individual case, and that an assessment and a review of each individual case was supposed to be conducted. Right? Wrong?
Exactly. The law was created in 1952, and the intent was, you know, if there were some special circumstances where somebody who was otherwise ineligible to enter the United States, they could be allowed in on a case-by-case basis. It spells that out very clearly in the law. It has to be on a case-by-case basis. It has to serve some compelling national interest or humanitarian interest, and that the stay in the United States is only supposed to be temporary. The Biden administration decided that they could use this law to let anybody in that they want. It didn't have to be on a case-by-case basis. You just showed up with the app, or in the case of four countries, Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Nicaragua and Venezuela, they created a special parole program. All you had to be was a citizen of one of those countries, and they were allowing 30,000 people in every single month. Clearly, this was an abuse of the law. We talked about the law. It's very clear about how it's supposed to be used. They decided they could just do whatever they want. And at one point last year, they were actually allowing more people into the United States under parole than we were granting green cards to people who were coming through the legal process. They basically were making a mockery of the law and getting away with it. And the new administration said, no, you know, we're not going to continue this. And not only that, we are going to reverse what the previous administration had done.
So I would imagine now that we've made this move operationally, how is this going to work? They're notifying people, telling them, we intend to deport you. What happens then if they don't self-deport?
Well, you know, they are subject to deportation. You know, if ICE comes and removes them, you know, they give them till a certain date to leave the country on their own. After that, if ICE comes and picks you up and deports you, then it becomes much, much more difficult to ever return to the country in the future. They're also going to revoke the work authorizations, along with all of these millions of people that Biden administration granted parole to. They've also granted work authorizations to these people. So they are out there competing for jobs with Americans. You know, the law of supply and demand says that, you know, if you have lots of people going after the jobs, the price of labor is going to go down. So it's suppressing wages for American workers. So, you know, all of these things have worked against the interests of the American public. Look, I mean, obviously not all of them are going to leave on their own, but there's certainly a clear message being sent that, number one, we're going to be looking for you. Number two, we're going to make it much more difficult for you to remain here because it's going to be harder to have employers hire you. Once that work authorization is revoked, you're not going to be able to get a lot of jobs. Only the most unscrupulous employers will hire you. So you systematically remove all the incentives for people to remain here. And eventually people do get the message, whether they're going to get it immediately or it's going to take a little bit of time. A combination of actively going out and finding people and removing them, plus discouraging them by saying, look, you know, all the reasons that you came here, those are no longer going to exist. It is time for you to go home. And that is what the objective here is. You find people, you remove them. Those people that you don't find, you convince them that there's no point in sticking around.
And what's interesting about these particular cases under the CBP One app, in the manner in which they came in under the parole, there was actually a time limitation that they could stay in the country, right? In that status, if we were to assume that this was legal to begin with, there was a limitation.
Yes, it had to be renewed every 2 years. The objective here was to get them into the country. You know, I guess at the time thought that they would be reelected and be in power for another 4 years, and they could find some other means to allow people to remain in the country. But essentially, they said, we're saying to people, look, you can come here for 2 years, and in that time, see if you can figure out some other reason to be allowed to remain here in the United States. And it's, you know, very likely that had the President Biden been reelected or Kamala Harris been elected, that they would have renewed these 2-year extensions just routinely, much the way they have been doing with temporary protected status. You know, once it's been given, it just gets renewed time and time again, regardless of the circumstances under which it was authorized in the first place. So the objective here was just to get people into the United States, create facts on the ground, because in their estimation, once people got here, it became very, very difficult for them to remove people. You know, at least this administration is endeavoring to do that. They have said, you've got to go home, and if you don't go home, we're going to remove you. If you stay here, we're going to revoke your work authorization. You know, it is not, we're not going to undo the damage of the previous administration all in one fell swoop. But, you know, if you do it little by little, it really does make an impact.
Let's pivot to one of the other parole programs that was set up, because I think the Trump administration is taking this same approach in trying to bring an end to this under the CHNV program, which was Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela parole program. What is the status of that?
Well, as of yesterday, it's been put on hold by a federal judge in Boston. The revocation was announced late March, and the administration said you've got 30 days to leave the United States. Obviously, the advocates for all the people who were let in under that program went to court. They found a favorable judge in Boston who issued a stay on that presidential order. So it's in the courts. But look, there is every reason to believe that the president has the authority to revoke a program that was put in place by his predecessor. If one president has the authority, and he didn't even have the authority, President Biden, to create this, certainly the next president has an equal right to come along and say, I'm changing the policy and I'm revoking it. So, you know, it's inevitable that all of these things wind up in the courts. People, the advocates for the illegal aliens know which judges and which courts to go to try to get some kind of injunction to prevent the administration from carrying out these policies. But, you know, it is going to be reviewed by higher courts. The Trump administration is going to appeal this decision. But eventually, you know, they are going to prevail on the merits because, number one, as we talked about, the previous administration had no legal authority to create this program. And, you know, one president can revoke the policies of another president. There's nothing in law. This was not a law. This was not legislation that brought these people to the country. It was simply a presidential action. And so a new president can reverse those actions.
And parole, what is in law about parole, does not confer legal status, right?
That's correct. You are here. You know, it's kind of a strange twilight zone. You are allowed to be in the country. You have lawful presence in this country, but you're still an illegal alien. And, you know, that doesn't change. Only Congress can change the status of those people through some kind of amnesty. That is not going to happen. So, you know, they're still here illegally. They are here because one administration decided they were going to allow them in. And now you have a new administration that ran on a platform saying we're not going to tolerate this anymore. And they're saying we are sending you home. We are revoking the status and giving you 30 days to leave.
Let me pivot, if you don't mind, to one other case, and I'm sure you know about it. The individual that's in the El Salvadoran prison, Brego Garcia, he is actually El Salvadoran. In a previous immigration, I guess, status review or whatever in court, they granted him the right to stay in this country because of the fear of his life and being deported back to El Salvador roughly 7-8 years ago because he was a member of a gang. And I don't understand how that becomes a protected status in this country, where in that country, your origin country, you choose to be a member of a gang and therefore you fear other gangs wanting to kill you, and you can use that as a justification to stay in this country? Am I reading this right? I mean, it sounds crazy to me.
Yeah, you know, apparently in the estimation of at least one judge, that is the case. But, you know, I think most people would look at this and say, you know, that's kind of crazy that, you know, you should not be able to claim asylum in this country because you're a member of one gang and you're in fear of another gang. Look, you know, when this new administration came to office, one of the first things that the president did was to declare very correctly that some of these transnational gangs are the equivalent of terrorist organizations. And that is one of the reasons he was able to invoke the Alien Enemies Act to expedite the removal of some of these folks. So, yeah, I mean, you're always going to find a judge somewhere who is going to issue some kind of crazy order. But the fact is, you know, there's no justification for allowing people to claim asylum in the United States based on being a member of the wrong gang. And, you know, it may take some time to rectify these things, but we're in the process of doing it. You know, we should not expect that everything is going to be rectified overnight. But clearly, you know, there is a concerted effort now, number one, to look at the status of gangs here in the United States and declare them very, very correctly a threat to the American public and to take steps to remove them.
But what's interesting about all of this, this lawfare, I guess, or lack, you know, I don't know if that's the appropriate term. It is in some cases, maybe not so in others, is really revealing the underbelly of immigration. And a lot of these people are having a difficult time connecting dots here. And the full, not the full plethora of the U.S. Constitution, but major portions of the U.S. Constitution are granted to individuals that came here uninvited, illegally. And, you know, we're jumping through all of these hoops and costing the taxpayer gobs of money in trying to have people play by the rules. It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Look, I mean, obviously, the previous administration suspended all the rules and people came here. We saw the result immediately at the onset of the Biden administration. They got the message that the borders were open, that if you came here, you'd be allowed to stay, that we'd grant you parole. You know, despite the fact that the previous administration had no legal authority to do any of those things, you do have people here. There are procedures that have to be followed, but, you know, they have to do something to get people to obey our laws. You know, there are steps that are going to be taken, including convincing people to leave on their own. You know, we have 18.6 million people in the country illegally. It is virtually impossible to find them all and remove them. What we can do is convince them that there's no reason to stay here. You're not going to get a job. You're not going to get access to non-emergency, non-essential public benefits and services. We will be looking for you. All of these things change the mindset. The same mindset that brought people here, oh, now the border's open. We're going to be able to do whatever we want once we get here. If you reverse those expectations, people will respond rationally. Obviously, you know, not all 18.6 million, but, you know, we should not let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Ira, maybe you can clear one thing up for me, and I don't know, from what I've been able to tell with my research, it's clear as mud. If you come to this country illegally, are you entitled to get a Social Security number? I remember, you know, in getting it for my kids, I had to present a birth certificate. And I had to present a birth certificate to prove citizenship, that they were born in this country, and therefore they are a citizen. How are folks that are non-U.S. born illegals getting Social Security? Can they get it? Are they allowed to? Is that legal?
Well, it depends, you know, taking us back to the parole status. The people who were paroled into the country are illegal aliens. However, because they entered with parole, that entitles them to work authorization. And with work authorization comes a Social Security number. So, you know, you do have millions of illegal aliens who do have valid Social Security numbers because of the way the Biden administration allowed them into the country and granted them work authorization. You know, if you just sneak across the border and enter the United States, you're not going to be eligible for parole. But if you use that CBP One app or came in as part of the CHNB parole program or other mechanisms that the Biden administration used to allow people into the country and give them work authorization, then they do have Social Security numbers.
So what happens to all the folks that have been sitting, you know, they filled out the forms, they paid the money, they're fulfilling all of the prerequisites to come to this country? I've interviewed people that have been waiting over 10 years to get in.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, It just seems to me patently unfair of what this administration did by letting people just jump in front of the line and they don't even have a ticket.
It wasn't just under the Biden administration. It's been going on for a long, long time. But essentially, we've been making chumps out of people who are playing by the rules. As you point out, people who play by the rules have to wait sometimes years and years. There are, you know, countless hoops that they have to jump through, whereas people who were just coming across the border were being allowed to stay here in the United States. You know, they were finding all kinds of ways to grant them benefits and work authorization. So, yeah, I mean, we have made a mockery of our own immigration system here in this country for, you know, it goes back way before the Biden administration. The people who really should be bearing the blame for this are, you know, just administration after administration that ignored the rules and essentially sent the message that if you come to the United States illegally, you're going to be rewarded, and at the expense of people who are trying to play by the rules. And that just isn't a fair system. And it's one of the reasons people resent what's going on so much.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons why our reputation around the world is impaired. We never talk about that, though, right? Because of what we're failing to do.
Yeah. It is our responsibility. You know, we have the authority to control who comes in here, to establish what the conditions are for entering the country. And it's up to us to enforce those rules.
No doubt. Thank you so much for joining us, Ira Melman, media director with FAIR. Truly appreciate your time, your insight, and have a great weekend.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Kirk Talbot, senator for the state of Louisiana. Kirk, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Newell.
No rest for the weary. We start Monday morning. What are top of mind issues for you with the upcoming session?
It'd be property insurance and auto insurance, which is getting a lot of attention, as it should. So those are the two things that I'm going to be focused on. Obviously, the budget is always a big issue, especially with those amendments going down. You know, that presents some challenges, but nothing like we haven't dealt with in the past when we had, you know, big budget holes or budget gaps. So I feel confident that we'll find the money to fund what we need to fund. And you know, by law, we have to have a balanced budget, and we will have a balanced budget.
Kurt, let's start with property insurance. I've been reading a number of stories, people alluding to the fact that we should anticipate property tax increase. I don't know if they're talking about Louisiana citizens or just other commercial carriers. What are you hearing?
Well, I know that Tim Temple, our commissioner, has publicly released that there's 11 or 12 new companies writing business. I had a constituent told me today that they got a better deal and they got a lower rate than what they were paying. And the message is, you know, you've got to go out and shop your policy. You can't just wait for your agent to call you and say, hey, Newell, I'm going to save you $1,200. You've got to shop it around probably every 6 months to see what's out there. There are companies coming. As far as citizens goes, you know, I had an amendment to a bill that we suspended that 10%, you know, where it's got to be 10% higher than the highest rate in your parish. We suspended that for 3 years. They did the similar thing after Katrina. I think they suspended it for 5. Obviously, that was a little bit different situation we have now, but not all that different. So I wouldn't look for that to go up, but it is it's a tough market right now. You know, the wildfires in California did not help because we all are tied to the global reinsurance market. And that was a, you know, a Category 5, if it was a hurricane type event. So that is going to present some challenges, but it, you know, the property insurance thing, it's going to take a while. You know, we had 2 good years. We need to keep going. And we know we're going to have more storms. We need to keep funding this fortified roof program, which we're going to do. We need to encourage people to do mitigation measures to protect their homes. And the ones that are doing that are getting better rates.
I thought there was an announcement that Citizens was going to have an increase in the upcoming year. Have they retreated from that?
It's not going to be 10% higher than the highest rate in your area like normal. I think, if I'm correct, it might be something like, you know, just to match the cost of living. I mean, it always goes up a little, right, just because of the cost of goods and the cost of repairing a home. But I wouldn't look at it to be significant like it was. Now, you know, we want to encourage people to get out of Citizens and to get into the better market. I mean, if you're in Citizens, you're still paying high. So I would encourage people that are in Citizens to shop around, especially with those who are in Citizens, to shop around, get in the, you know, apply for the fortified roof grant. We had a state audit. The state auditor released a report a couple of weeks ago. On average, people are saving 22% with a fortified roof. That's 2% better than they're saving in Alabama. So that, we're excited about that. And I filed a bill to do a non-refundable tax credit for the same amount that you would get if you were in the lottery. In other words, the lottery's $10,000. They give you, you get $10,000 to apply towards a fortified roof. In some cases, if it's a smaller home, it's less than 10. It's probably going to be more like, 15 to 16, but you'll save money in the long run, trust me. So my bill would say, look, Newell, if you can afford it, go ahead and put the roof on and take a $10,000 non-refundable tax credit that you can spread out over 3 years if you don't have that much tax liability in year one and two, and let's get these roofs on as fast as we can, because that's the real long-term solution to our problem here in South Louisiana.
What are you hearing on the wind mitigation survey front? I was talking to a person who actually monitors the fortified roof program and wind mitigation, and he said his experience at the present time is that people are getting far greater discounts with the wind mitigation survey than they are with fortified roofs.
Well, we know they're getting 22% on average with the fortified roof, but the wind mitigation survey, and for your listeners that may not be familiar with that, you know, you pay somebody, I think it's $350 around that, to come out and they'll survey your roof and your, do they have trees next to your house or your windows and all that. And if you get a good survey, like you've taken some good measures, you are getting significant decreases in the constituent I mentioned had that survey done and got a better rate. So doing that and coupled with getting a fortified roof is even better. But, you know, the more roofs that go on, the better off we're all going to be. But even just getting the survey is, people, like you said, are seeing good discounts come through.
Let's pivot to auto insurance. I guess it looks like the battle royale is yeah, kind of brewing out there again between the trial lawyers and the insurance companies. I know that there's been an attempt by the governor, yourself and others, bringing the parties together, trying to create some open conversations about potential legislation that could assist. How do you feel about it?
Those meetings are going on daily with all sides. And, you know, there's a lot of bills out there. The House members filed a lot of bills. Senators filed a decent amount of bills as well. And those conversations are ongoing. And I'm encouraged. It seems like this thing has kind of taken a life of its own. I've been fighting this and been at this for a while, as you know. But it seems like there's just a more diverse group of legislators that are involved in this. Clearly, everybody's constituents are feeling this. And, you know, the more we talk about it, it's not like property insurance where we know we live in a state that's along the coast. We know we have a high population that's in coastal zones that are vulnerable to hurricanes. There's no reason why we should be the highest auto insurance in the country. No one around us is in the top, I think, 7 or 8 or even 10. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel here, Newell. We just need to look at what other states are doing. And we've got to get the number of lawsuits under control. And that clearly, in my opinion, and from the data, is driving our rates.
Just yesterday, I think it was, it seems as though things are getting a little snarky as it relates to the level of regulatory authority that the insurance commissioner presently enjoys and whether or not there should be more. I recall vividly when he ran that he said more is not necessarily better in the eyes of the industry, that the market forces need to prevail. The governor seems to be of a different mindset. What's happening on this front?
Well, there's definitely two schools of thought. One is we need a legal reform. I guess there's three. One, is it legal reform? Two, is it regulation? And three, is it a balance by the both of them? And I think the commissioner and the governor both want a balanced approach. They may not be on the same page today, but we hope that will change. And, you know, from what I understand about the commissioner and his power and his office is that it's very similar to 29 or 30 other states. He has the ability to deem rates excessive. He has deemed rates excessive. When I was House Chair under Commissioner Jim Donilon, we had these same discussions, and we saw the same thing out of his office. If rates were actuarially justified, where they had to raise them or go out of business, they raised them. And in some cases, he denied their raises. And he you know, reversed that because it wasn't actuarially justified. So I think that system is working, and it's not dissimilar to what most of the commissioners already have. You know, what we don't want is for the commissioner's office to be a one-man rating commission. Because the rating commission, if you recall, that was before, I think even before Jim Donilon became commissioner years ago, that was a disaster. It was ripe with political corruption. It was winners and losers and very corrupt, and it did not help our situation. And no state does it like that. No state has a commissioner that is a one-man or one-woman rating commission. You want to keep the facts involved. You want to keep the data involved, the actuarial tables involved. And that's what we have now, and we need to keep doing that.
Kirk, I know that you stay abreast of a lot of this. I'm curious, are you and your peers watching what's going on in California?
We are.
You have a lot of insurance companies walking. People can't get loans because they can't get homeowners. And they're kind of caught in this circular thing.
And California is one of the few states. They don't have a one-person rating commission, but they have an insurance commissioner. Then they have like a committee that can decide and influence rates. And in my opinion, it's not working. And I think the proof's in the pudding. Big companies like Allstate and State Farm, they're leaving California because of it's overregulated in California, and it's not working there. And I don't want to go to where, you know, if you're willing to leave, what is it, the fifth or sixth largest economy in the world, they will leave Louisiana very quickly, especially with our challenges. So we got to be real careful about, you know, that balance between regulation and, you know, obviously insurance companies, we want them to make a profit because I want them to pay my claim when I need them. I'm not paying them a premium for them to all of a sudden say, hey, we're bankrupt when I need them, because that's what I'm paying them to do. And I want them to be there when I need them. So that's kind of the balance. But yes, we are. And what's going on in California before the wildfires is troubling, to say the least.
Yeah, it's like a science project right before us, right? I mean, it's very interesting. I can't help it, and I shouldn't say it this way, but I mean, I kind of chuckle, but I feel horrible for these folks because they really believe that they were going to reestablish Pacific Palisades in a year. It's like, what are you talking about? They've issued two, as of last week, they've issued two building permits. And
right,
in a year.
I mean, I wish them well, but I don't think they're going to get it done.
10 years. It took us 10 years, and we didn't lose structures. We just flooded structures. So a lot of our structures were actually saved. We just needed to rehab them. They don't have anything.
I mean, they have nothing. It's a really dire situation out there, and I pray for them and I feel for them.
Yeah, but it's really going to be a test, though, and an interesting thing to follow for you guys. And I'm glad to hear that y'all are, because I think they've already made some missteps, and I think insurance companies are getting already very wary of whether or not they want to stay there.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. All things start, what, Monday, right?
Start Monday, and we go 60 days. It's a short one. assuming we have no special sessions, we hope to get it all wrapped up in 6 days. That's the plan. But we got a big agenda and a lot on the plate, and I think we're moving in the right direction.
Well, thank you for joining us. Truly appreciate it. Have a great weekend. Thank you, sir.
You too.
Kirk Talbot, Louisiana State Senator. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. So there it is. We visited with the president of the Senate yesterday, Kirk Talbot, today, and it seems as though property and auto insurance is going to be top-of-mind issue, as well as the budget. There is a balanced budget requirement in the state of Louisiana. They seem to be very optimistic and hopeful that they will be able to achieve same. Insurance issue, when I say top of mind, it truly is. A lot of chatter about this, and already we're seeing some tug-of-wars going back and forth, some snarky comments about different perspectives. I think they're feeling the political pressure. Folks are tired. I look at the text that I have right now, people wondering why there's never a reduction in their homeowners. And I think Senator Talbot provided some really good advice. Shop your policies. And I can tell you, it worked for me. I worked with my agent. I told him I want to be out there as often as I can. They have been. In fact, we went back to Citizens, to be quite frank with you, saved, I think it was about $3,500 less than what I was paying before, with better coverage. That's what really shocked me. Better coverage, $3,500 less a year in premium with Citizens. And you heard Senator Talbot said, you really don't want to be with Citizens because we're not the cheapest. But for me at that point in time, that was the cheapest opportunity we had. Now, since then, I know that there are new companies that are in the market. We will shop it again to see what the return is going to be. It's, you know, nothing gained, nothing lost. I mean, you go out there, see what the market's bearing, see what you can ultimately get. On the wind mitigation survey, as was pointed out by Senator Talbot as well, I've talked to a lot of people that have been the beneficiary of reduction in premium because of the survey. I've also talked to people where it had no impact at all. You're out $350, I think is what the average going rate is for that. You know, it's a little bit of a gamble. It may be worth it, maybe not. Some of the guys, I'm told, they will tell you they can show up at your house and just tell by the design of your house whether or not you're going to do well or not. You just need to be out there, be aggressive right now in the troubled times that we find ourselves. The agents and others in the insurance companies, they expect this. They're used to it. So don't feel like you're putting anybody out. $3,500 is a lot of money to save. And I was shocked, quite frankly, because I was moving in the opposite direction exponentially. Now, I may end up there again at the expiration of this policy. I don't know. But, at least during the pendency of this year, save some money. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we want to hear from you. We'll go to open lines, No Filter Friday. We can talk about anything that you want to talk about, and there are a lot of hot topics out there. So give us a shout. We'll be right back.